Blog Talk Radio.
What? Wanna see my ID?
In America.
Going West Philly.
In America.
Plays overseas.
In America.
African in my jeans.
In America.
Said I'm stuck on police. I don't got any beef. So why they wanna be me?
In America.
They kill the natives with disease. Smallpox and sheep. African and Chinese.
In America.
Young soldiers go die.
For America.
Unemployment too high.
In America.
Got the prisons real big.
In America.
Gangsters feel weird.
In America.
A lot of guns okay. They sick to play. They steal the money all day.
In America.
Don't get paid, 98 in the shade, and life feel like a maid.
In America.
I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know, be self-evident that there is power in numbers.
Shit ain't sweet, many live on the street without nothing to eat.
In America.
And many kids fool by, all the TV stars, you can see drive by.
In America.
But we can live like that.
In America.
How many live like that?
In America.
I never lived like that.
In America.
Nobody lives like that.
In America.
You and I have never seen this. This is a new generation.
Welcome to another edition of Your World News. I'm your host, Solomon, and you strap up. This is going to be a hell of a show. A very important show. We're going to be talking about education. We're going to talk about the continued onslaught on public education in this country that's been going on for quite some time. But for some reason, a lot of people seem to think that Barack Obama and the presidency this attack has ceased, but it, matter of fact, it's gotten more aggressive than we've seen in a long time. This whole charter school scam and the race to the top has upped a notch. And so we've seen that as vile a mental midget that George Bush was, and he was. We've seen that Barack Obama is getting away with things that Republicans could only dream about in their wildest wet dreams. You know, we see an escalation of the military spending under this administration, and these conservative attacks on public education continue to go on. I wouldn't say unabated, because there are people on the ground level that are fighting this tooth and nail, but we see with the complete firing of, or not firing, but the threat of firing, over 1,000 public school teachers in Providence, Rhode Island. We see that state had an attack on Central Falls, the city of Central Falls, which is probably about a half hour from Providence. The past year. We see Detroit public schools beginning attacked. We see this whole charter school, and everything's working under the illusional guise of the whole charter school scam. Okay, so we're going to get into that. I'm really excited. Peter's going to be joining us soon. Peter Fowler is going to be joining us soon from Glendale, Arizona. We have Dr. Danny Weil, who is, in my estimation, one of the top educational scholars in this country. He's been writing on public education and charter schools for a long time. And he also has been writing on critical thinking for a long, long time. He's the publisher of many books, and the author of literally hundreds of articles, if not into the thousands of articles on a range of things, including public schools and unions and corporatocracy and military industrial complex. I mean, Danny has covered it, but he's going to be joining us at about half after the hour, And like I said, so I'm going to welcome Peter Fowler on the line to give his honorable salutations to all of you, the Your World News listeners. And then we're going to hit the ground running. We're going to have a clip that is salient to everything that we're discussing today. Actually, a couple of clips that are salient to what we're discussing. And we'll hit the ground running. So, as usual, the call-in number is 347-945-5191. Once again, that's 347-945-5191. So at any point, I would say, excluding the dialogue with Danny Wild, because there's a lot of stuff that we want to cover with him, but you're welcome to call in with your thoughts, your feedback, or, you know, if you just want to, just sit back and relax and listen to the progressive analysis of news and information that you will not get from the corporate media. The corporate media that has been fornicating with Capitol Hill for quite some time. So, without further ado, I'm welcoming Peter Fowler on the line. Peter, you're on the line.
Right here, bro.
Say hello to our revolutionary listeners.
Gentlemen, good to be with you. Hello to you, and hello to all of our listeners. And I can only hope, and I can only plea with everyone listening that each and every one of you are of a revolutionary mindset, because this is a time when we need to strike a blow for progressive radical ideas to take down the domination system, and you know, this is just our one of our small contributions to that, and we depend on you, the listeners, to help spread the word of what we're doing. So we hope that you call in. We hope that you spread the links to the show, get the word out there, and do your part too to get engaged in critical thinking, and right. And deconstructing these dominant narratives the way we do. So let's do it, bro. I'm looking forward to this show. Looking forward to having Danny on and talking about the critical subject of education.
Right. And so without further ado, I'm going to actually start with a clip that I think is pretty apropos. This was featured on Black Agenda Report. This is Brother Glenn Ford. This was about a week ago. And, you know, because it just gotten to the point, you know, some folks have jumped off the boat, the Obama ship, and some folks have stopped drinking the Obama Kool-Aid, the Obama aid, and have realized that, you know, the stuff is not good for their health. It's not good for their communities, and they need to wake up. And certainly, Peter and I, if you know us, if you've been listening to the show enough, you know we're certainly not advocating going to the Republican Party. But within this, you know, rigged electoral political system in the United States, in order for us to see any kind of progressive and sustained change, we're going to have to see the formation of progressive, like truly progressive, third and fourth parties. We're going to have to see the establishment of strong independent candidates that are progressive and radical in nature. And until then, we're going to continue to be sheep for the slaughter for these Capitol Hill capitalists and right wingers that make up most of the Democrat and Republican Party. You know, as I said, make up most of the Democrat and Republican Party. So it's not to say that there are not some Democrats that are within the restrictive party that they continue to allow themselves to be a part of, that are actually, you know, somewhat progressive. But by and large, the party is corporate dominated, as is the Republican Party. And, you know, so, you know, we really need to think about these things as we look at these mass protests in places like Wisconsin and other places. You know, if we can mobilize, as folks are doing in Wisconsin, then we can mobilize towards creating a progressive party that is a counter to these clowns, this mirage that is the Democratic Party. So here we go with Glenn Ford.
The first black president just gave birth to an unmistakably Republican budget, and everybody knows who that ugly baby's daddy is. For the past 2 years, Barack Obama has been making out quite publicly with George Bush's corporate friends. But that shouldn't be a scandal. After all, Obama has always told everyone in range of his voice that his main goal in life is to forge a grand consensus with the GOP, a bipartisan understanding between the right and the center-right. The result is an Obama budget that is all sliced up like the loser in a knife fight. Only Obama and his corporate executives on loan at the White House did all the cutting themselves. Obama is showing such extraordinary talent for obliterating poor and working people's programs across the board, he's making Republicans look redundant and obsolete. From community block grants to Section 8 housing vouchers to child care to Pell grants to home heating oil for the poor, Obama has preemptively savaged all that decent people hold dear in the social safety net, and is in enthusiastic, principled agreement with the Republicans that the big cuts are still to come in Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. Obama has arrived in his element, and he has nothing to be ashamed about. Way back on the campaign trail, he told everyone willing to listen how much he admired President Reagan. So why be surprised when you get a Reagan-type budget? No, the shame is not Obama's. The people who should be scandalized by the president's budget are the enablers on the left who abrogated their political responsibility to the people and to truth by inventing an Obama that did not exist back in 2007 and 2008. The shame of the proposed 2012 budget rests on the heads of those blacks and progressives in leadership positions who chose to mislead their constituencies in 07 and 08, who refused to make even one demand or even a mild request of Obama, the candidate, and thus rendered blacks and progressives politically irrelevant. As we at Black Agenda Report and honest analysts like Paul Street pointed out all along, Obama has always been a dangerous corporate creature. But like the frog that allows the scorpion to hitch a ride on his back across the swollen river, black and progressive misleaders act shocked and hurt when Obama stings them with his deadly budget halfway through his term. But the frog should have known the nature of the scorpion. Obama's corporate character was no secret to anyone except those who wished not to know. Despite being dazzled by Obama's skin color and charm, there is still a consensus among black Americans on issues of social justice. With his draconian cuts, President Obama is violating that consensus so sharply it cannot be papered over for the sake of racial pride. We were pleased to learn that Congressman Emanuel Cleaver, chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, has dramatically distanced himself from Obama's budget priorities. The heads of traditional black organizations would be wise to do the same. African Americans are watching their Obama dreams turn into nightmares. Sometime soon, they will demand an accounting from those who misled them into the lair of the scorpion. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Toward. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
Into the lair of the scorpion. Peter, in your estimation, Peter, what can you tell our listeners? Because maybe there's some listeners listening right now, Peter, that say, hey, why are you being so hard on Obama? You know, give me some proof through your rhetoric what the Obama administration, headed by Barack Obama himself, what kind of attacks have they, why are they no friends, I should say? Why is this administration no friend to the working class, to poor, to even people of color, you know, brown Latinos and black people? Peter, what would you say to that?
Well, yours is a salient question, Solomon. The question that you kind of hypothetically put to me from a skeptic, I think I would have to reframe. I would have to reframe that question, though. I would have to say, no, the impetus would be on you to tell me why I should not be harsh on Obama, all right? In other words, there's this implication or almost this unspoken rule among a lot on the left, and especially among African Americans, that it's taboo to even criticize Barack Obama because he's black, because he's phenotypically brown-skinned, that he's off limits. And we've seen that from the what Glenn Ford calls the black misleadership class, that they have failed to hold Obama's feet to the proverbial fire in terms of taking demands to President Obama, to the Obama administration, the demands of the poor, the demands of the disenfranchised, the demands of African Americans. And this is the first administration since emancipation that has been the case, that leftist and progressive and black American concerns and agendas have not been taken to the newly inaugurated president and presented and said, you know, hey, here's our agenda, here's our demands, what are you going to do about it, and continually been pressured. That's not been the case with Barack Obama at all. And, in fact, Barack Obama, ironically enough, if there's no other indictment, this is it. Barack Obama is the first president in recent memory, certainly, to come out and say straight-facedly that there are no particular problems with black America, that the problems facing Americans are American problems, and that everything is, like colorblind. I mean, if this isn't the most wishy-washy Casper Milquetoast character that's sat in the White House with regard to the needs of African Americans, I don't know who is. I mean, it's one thing, we knew with George Bush that he was just flat-out hostile to black people. You know, Kanye West caught a lot of flack, but he was spot on when he said George Bush doesn't like black people. Well, there was no secret. You know, of course he did not like black people. Republicans in general, progressives in particular, you know, George Bush being one of them, but their mouthpiece. But Barack Obama, if you look at his deeds, not his words, his actions, they have, as Glenn Ford has pointed out in that piece and in other pieces, Barack Obama's actions have looked more Reagan-esque than some of Reagan's policies. Barack Obama has pushed through and enacted more policies that look more like Reagan policies than the kind of things that George Bush Jr. would have been able to get away with. I'm getting my words mixed up because I get so angry at that question. And we've got to look at the facts. And like we say, show me the money, right? Well, that Glenn's piece on the budget is a definitive case of Barack Obama's priorities and his particular place on the ideological spectrum. To think that he is even to the center of the ideological spectrum, as it has to do with working people and it has to do with the masses of African-American people in this country, is ridiculous. Look at the money. Show me the money. Anybody's checkbook, anybody who's listening, you just look at your checkbook, you look at your bank account, you look at the receipts that you got scattered around your coffee table, and you can see where your priorities are. And the Obama budget demonstrates where his priorities lie. And those priorities lie with advancing the agenda of the ruling class. That, make no mistake about it, there's no other way to parse the language. He is one of the pack of wolves of the ruling class, and the policies and the budget particularly that he is pushing through is going to be devastating, absolutely devastating to working class people in general, black Americans in particular. If you look at the housing debacle over the last couple of years, it has disproportionately affected African Americans. If we want to talk about particulars, the housing bubble, African Americans have lost the vast majority of their wealth because for most black Americans, even the attainment of material wealth has been relatively recent, like post-World War II or even post-1960s. And so most of that wealth has been tied up in home ownership because many African Americans have been caught up in that whole American dream hoodwink scandal. And so they bought into this home ownership thing, and most of their wealth is tied up in that. And when those, when houses are upside down and mortgages are called in, that wealth is lost. And we don't have time now to go into the statistics, but I encourage our listeners to still go do some research on that and see how that housing debacle has disproportionately devastated black Americans. Lastly, Glenn Ford said that Obama's budget and basically Obama in general He's making Republicans look obsolete and unnecessary. You know, and I would agree with that. You know, that this great consensus that Obama is obtaining to is basically saying, you know what, I'm going to come out and I'm going to rule as a Republican, as to the right on the ideological spectrum. So my question is for the regressives now who continue to attack Barack Obama, what basis do they have to attack Barack Obama? You know, how are they going to come out and say, well, he's a socialist, you know, and he's a leftist, and he's a radical, and he's, you know, going to undo America and all this other crap, all that crap we heard, you know, going all the way back to the campaign in 2007, 2008. You know, now any critique of Barack Obama has to be laid bare as just bald-faced racism, you know, and basically folks have no political, no policy-based, no budget-based, no ideological base to criticize Barack Obama. From the right, the only thing that's left is the fact that he is, you know, brown skinned, phenotypically Black American, and so it's going to be interesting to see who does continue to attack Barack Obama. And obviously, there's going to be, you know, I mean, you know, the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks and the open racists like that. We expect them to come out and continue to do that, but it's going to be interesting to engage people who are even possible to engage in conversation if they continue to come out and attack Barack Obama, because just, you know, show me a policy that is not in line with a right-wing or Republican ideology. You can't find one. He is entirely Reagan-esque. Glenn Ford said it best, you know, that he's all the way back on the campaign trail. He has revered Reagan. He said it again just recently. And we're seeing now since the elections last fall, that he has now he feels free to be the right wing president that he really is. We're really seeing the true colors of Barack Obama, and they're ugly colors. They really are. It's really an ugly scene, and you know, it's going to be interesting to look back on 2011 and the years hence in the future and see what kind of things Barack Obama will ultimately be responsible for with this budget, these policies, and where we go from here.
Right. And we know, you know, to Lou, what you were saying, you know, to really pinpoint it, you know, the bottom 60% in terms of you know, income, the bottom 60% of Americans have approximately about 65% of their net worth tied up in their homes, while the top 1%, in a very stark, you know, a very stark contract, have only 10% tied up in their housing. You know, so, you know, that's letting folks know, like, how, you know, how vastly, like, different the disparity is. And you know, what's crazy is that the disparity, you know, the last 30 years between the rich and the poor, has the chasm has gotten wider and wider. Right. And wider and wider and wider. You know, we see, you know, more and more people, you know, going into food hardship, you know, which is, you know, food stamps or the food, you know, credit card that they now give, that is now customarily given out. That is all, obviously, we talked about this last show, backed and profited by the likes of J.P. Morgan, you know, that produces those cards. You know, and so, you look at that, not countries, but states like, might as well be other countries, but, you know, states like Mississippi, their food hardship rate is about, you know, 25%. You know, that's 25% of that state that is receiving, you know, some kind of food subsidies from the government, food stamps, you know, WIC. You know, you move a little further out west towards where you are, Peter. You know, California, 20%, you know, Arkansas, you know, 20%, you know, South Carolina, 24%, you know, so it's just, you know, Montana, 20%. I mean, this is amazing. And if anyone's been, which most of us have, been to the grocery store lately, I mean, it's astronomical. I went to the grocery store, last week, and was going through a checkout aisle, and it was astronomical, like what my food bill was for, and that was the first time I had gone grocery shopping in quite some time, because, you know, for a number of reasons, busy and you know, just couldn't do that kind of grocery shopping, but once every so often. And then if you want to eat healthy, you know, I'm somewhat health conscious or health conscientious, you know, in terms of what I put in my body. And, you know, and it's, and, you know, the better the food is for you, it's more expensive. And it may seem like I'm going on a tangent, but this is, you know, but I'm not. This is all, you know, eating habits and all this stuff, you know, and the cost of food, it's all connected towards the lower classes, you know what I'm saying, lower middle classes, you know, and folks spend a lot of time talking about the middle classes, which is very important, but you never hear the corporate media, you know, hardly ever talking about is spending a great deal of time talking about the lower classes. And yes, and it's deplorable that we actually have to say middle classes, lower classes, but in a capitalist nation like this, you know, capitalism in a capitalist, you know, state in which we live in, you know, being America, it is completely based on having lower classes. You know, you can't have an upper class without a lower class, and those folks that are in the upper classes, especially the top 1%, you know, these are folks, and you know, many of these folks have, you know, own these large businesses, some own large corporations. They bank on making sure that, you know, that they can exploit workers, and the workers, you know, have no control over the means of production. You know, they're just producing, you know, widgets and an assembly line, you know, whatever it is, whether it's clothing or car parts or what have you. And the sick thing is, Peter, and folks listening, is that those folks, the folks that work in these factories that have these, like, largely exploitive rates and lack of benefits, and we're going to get into unions. We see this attack on unions, so they're trying to attack unions so unions can't advocate for an actual living wage. But most of these people, Peter, they can't even afford you know, the products that they're producing. They can't afford the clothes, the shoes that they're producing. So, anyways, Danny Wild's on the line. We got to get going, and now I'm going to start off for Danny on the other end. Danny's going to join us, but I'm going to play this clip for Glenn Ford, by Glenn Ford for Danny. I think this is a great segue to bring Danny on the line, and this is it's a perfect segue. And then on the other line, we're going to have Dr. Danny Wild.
Corporate America and its servants in the Democratic and Republican parties care nothing for the education of black inner-city school children, and the proof is in Detroit for all to see. The state of Michigan, controlled like every other state in the country by big business interests, has ordered Detroit to close down half of its public schools and increase class sizes to 60 students. That's double the number that any respectable educator considers suitable for classroom work, and tantamount to a declaration that Detroit's public school students will not be providing an education at all. In a modern society, this is the equivalent of declaring Detroit, an overwhelmingly black metropolis, a failed state. This racist outrage is blamed on a $327 million school budget deficit, just as when the public schools were decimated twice before in recent years, eliminating 79 schools and reducing enrollment to about 84,000 students. Many of those public schools were then sold to private charter school companies. With every assault on public education, charter schools multiplied. Now, 54,000 Detroit students attend charter schools, and even before the current crisis, the corporate enemies of public education were gleefully predicting that charters would overtake public school enrollment by around 2015, which would make Detroit the second major American city in which charters outnumber public schools. The other city is New Orleans, where 70% of the students attend charter schools, the highest proportion in the nation. New Orleans and Detroit have something else in common. They have lost more population than any other U.S. cities. And if that is not by design, then why are so many rich white people so happy about it? The rulers of America have decided that predominantly black cities are to become relics of the nation's past. In New Orleans, they had a hurricane to help them with their ethnic cleansing. But elsewhere, public policies must be crafted that make the cities uninhabitable for much of the existing black population. Sometimes gentrification does the trick, but one needs lots of affluent white people to push black folks out of town, and that takes time. But Detroit is to be emptied out in a hurry by doubling classroom size and utterly ruining the public schools. Then the education entrepreneurs and hedge fund managers and billionaires can build the kind of charter school system they want, with the kind of children they want, and without the teachers' union, which they definitely do not want. The privatizers always claim they have only the best interests of the kids at heart. But if that were the case, they would never even consider doubling classroom size to 60 students and keeping it that way for at least the next 4 years, during which time very few students would learn anything. After 4 years of deliberate torture of children, lots of those kids and their parents will be gone, which is an important object of this cruel exercise. And if the privatizers have their way, the teachers' union will be busted. Then who will be left to demand, as Detroit's teachers have repeatedly done, that classrooms be small enough for students to have at least a chance to learn? For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to www.blackagendareport.com.
And with that, I'm going to give a warm welcome. This is not his first time on the show. Dr. Danny Weil has been on our show previously. He's joined us from California. And as I said before, Danny has written numerous books, has written a hell of a book on education. You can find his work on Amazon.com. Just go into Amazon.com and just type in Danny, last name W-E-I-L. It's anyone that's interested in books on education and also critical thinking. He's done a lot of scholarly work around critical thinking and the necessary implementation of critical thinking curricula, you know, within the school system. Obviously, our school systems are devoid of any kind of critical thinking curriculum for an obvious reason. They need all of us, and they need our kids to be mindless drones to go out there and to carry on mindlessly, you know, to act as the bewildered herd that Walter Lippmann, you know, glowingly spoke of. You know, if he had his wet dreams come true, that's what he would love to, you know, to, as he watches from hell, watches you know, these kids continue to be a part of what he deemed the bewildered herd. But Danny is a comrade of mine, and it's a thrill to have him on the show. So, Danny, welcome to Your World News.
Well, thank you very much for having me again, Solomon, and thank you for Mr. Ford's so well said analysis of what's going on in the city of Detroit, as well as, of course, what's happened in New Orleans and what is happening pretty much throughout the entire United States. What he's describing is we're barreling as a country toward a new neo-feudalism. Modern neo-feudalism, where there will be a pyramid with a small 1% at the top, which there is now, and the vast majority of us at the bottom. It's interesting to note, and then, of course, I won't ramble on, I'll let you get specific, that New Orleans has lost one-third of its population. New Orleans, one-third of its population, and, of course, Detroit is experiencing the same. So these are deeply wounded cities that lie underneath the umbrella or the canopy of a corporate state. And this is kind of a permanent underclass we're creating here in the banana republic that we're becoming.
Right, right. And Danny, I want to hit the ground running. So I want to ask you if you can shed some light to myself and Peter and the rest of our listeners. You know, because, you know, there's far, far too many people that are still on the Obama administration's bandwagon. And so I just wanted to kind of, you know, in relation to education, want to ask you if you could paint a picture in terms of what kind of attacks this administration has unleashed on public education, as well as its teachers and its teachers' unions. And, you know, through the guys of Race to the Top, and maybe some a lot of folks have no idea what Race to the Top is, but you could compare and contrast, like, Race to the Top to Bush's No Child Left Behind.
Yes, yeah, certainly, Solomon. If I might, can I take just a moment to kind of give a macro overview, I think, that might be necessary to understand what's going on. I and there's a wonderful economist by the name of Richard Wolff who has written a book called Capitalism Hits the Fan. I would recommend it for readers. It's very very easy to understand. But it's important that we understand that in this country, in the United States, from 1871 to approximately the 1970s, we had an economy of social mobility. Now, of course, this wasn't shared by all people. There was racism, as there still is, and sexism, of course, as there still is, as well as homophobia, and of course, immigrants were oftentimes discriminated. But by and large, America was known for a land for 100 years, from 1871, ironically, the time of the Paris Commune, to 1970s as really being upwardly socially mobile society. Now, what happened, of course, is up until the 1970s, there was a labor shortage in the United States. We manufactured everything. We exported it all to the world. Capital needed far much more labor than they had. And as a result, wages rose, unionization rose. But in the 1970s, this all changed. And what happened is the introduction of automation, the beginning of the offshoring of industry, and of course women entering the labor force, not wishing to be considered second class citizens, meant that there was now not a labor shortage anymore. There was a labor surplus, and we began to see manufacturing start to disappear and service work begin to take hold. And what happened is there was an oversupply of labor, and that meant that the cost of labor went down. And that's what happens under capitalism. So more worker productivity was squeezed out of workers for the last 33 years. From around 78 till now, we saw that there has been no increase in wages whatsoever, adjusted for inflation. Wages have stagnated, whereas productivity has skyrocketed. And the gains of the productivity, of course, haven't been shared. 80% of all the wealth created in the last 33 years has gone to 1% of the population. Now, this is, can all be verified. It's not making up statistics. And then in the 1970s, we saw families beginning to disintegrate. The stress of work and overproductivity and automation and alienation began to take hold. And this is basically been the last 35 years here in the United States. And so The problem with capitalism is that capitalism has to keep growing, and so once a system was put into place where productivity was up and there was a reserve labor army, in other words, more labor needed than was needed, and people were working harder and faster, and wages were flat. How could you get more profit out of workers? I mean, today 1% of the population owns 52% of all financial assets. And so they couldn't squeeze more from U.S. labor. And so what capitalism had to do is they had to continue to outsource, and they had to create their own economy for themselves. They had too much money. And where were they sitting on trillions of dollars worth of money? Where are we going to invest this money? We can't invest it in the U.S. So they created a system now where 40% of the U.S. economy is financialized. And this meant hedge funds, derivatives. Meanwhile, the U.S. working class isn't getting anything out of this whole thing. And then in the 1980s, we see the age of the CEO gurus. And we saw this in the 90s, the Jack Welches that could run the companies. And the media, of course, played this all up, and it rationalized now what is 500-to-1 pay scale from CEOs to workers. Say, CEO now gets $500 for every $1 a worker gets. And the way they rationalized this was to blame all this wonderful increase in wealth on CEOs. Workers didn't have anything to do with it. It was CEOs.
Right.
So we've gotten ourselves here to a situation where now it's beginning to crash. Capital began to realize that in an economy that's beginning to lose all of its social mobility, they need to control politics. And in order to control politics, to sustain a society where the antisocial mobility is prevalent, they must control all the institutions. So you began to see the rise of the think tanks, the right-wing think tanks in the last 33 years. And of course, all of this has come together in a perfect storm. So really, a lot of the problems that we're seeing in education now have really nothing to do with reform of education or increasing the students' ability to learn or to critically think in a democracy. The discussions we're having in education today are really about containment. How are we going to contain a surplus population of workers, most of them black and Latino, who will never work in this country? There's no work.
Right.
The private sector can't create work. And the federal government refuses to do so. I mean, Roosevelt in 1938, from 34 to 38, employed 11 million people through federal programs. Why aren't we taxing the rich 10% more? Why are we not starting federal programs and paying people who are not working today to go out and build our bridges and maintain our roads? And the answer is very clear, because the ruling class does not want to invest in this country. It's a divestment situation. They've divested all their money from this country. It sits overseas. They have homes overseas if they need to escape. They have no interest in the country. So it really, the educational reform dialogue is a phony dialogue. There's you have one poll that talks about, oh, we're not competing with China enough, you know, and you would think this would be a right wing that wants to get our kids to compete with China. They have no interest in our kids competing with China. Our kids are going to be working at Walmart, or as I drove by the other day on the corner of my street here, their kids dressed up for IRS Day in April in Statue of Liberty uniforms, human billboards on street corners. Children are being turned into nothing more than used hand tools and commodities for belligerent advertising campaigns. And then, of course, demonized and vilified in the press with zero-tolerance programs sent into the incarceration rates of children in this country is absolutely incredible. And right. And the school-to-jail programs are very, very well-known and very prevalent. So there's really no interest in education. The interest is to make sure there is no educated child. The issue is to leave every child behind, except certain children. And those children will then go to private schools. And then for the kids in the Detroit, for example, that Mr. Ford spoke about, the working-class children that are black or Latino or white or whatever, but especially in communities of black and Latino, these children will eventually be put into cyber learning centers. I really believe that our educational system will turn into little more than a call center that could be run from India. K-12 Inc., for example, run by Bill Bennett, the former under Reagan, I think it was, or Bush, Secretary of Education, you know, is the founder of K-12 Inc., along with Milken, the junk bond dealer, who's out of prison with a felony. But they have billions of dollars, and anytime you go on the Internet, you'll see their ads. K-12 Inc. They're taking over schools in Michigan, as I wrote about in Daily Censored. They've cornered the market on K-12 education and virtual online. So they get rid of the real estate, and that way they don't need the gardeners, and they don't need to put the sprinkler systems on. And they turn the real estate into either gentrified projects, or you go to Camden, New Jersey, you don't get food in your city. Food has to be brought over, let's say, to Camden, New Jersey. It's fresh vegetables and fruits, for example, have to be brought because of the control of the agribusiness. It has to be carted from California to Camden, New Jersey, and by the time it gets there, it's very expensive. Black folks in Camden, New Jersey, they can't afford the cost of tomatoes, and so you don't even see a supermarket there. There's Popeye's chicken and donut shops, grease and sugar. We really must understand that the monopolists, the corporatists, the ruling class, the capitalists, however you want to say it, their interest is not to educate our kids, it's to make sure our kids don't get educated. Because if our kids get educated, they'll threaten their power.
So why the charter schools, and
you know, Race to the Top has been shaped as something that's good, and charter schools have been formulated to be something that's a good thing, and then the mass propaganda with you know, Waiting for Superman, you know, pins the problems, the public school problems, on teachers and teachers unions. So why charter schools? And I'm glad you brought up Bill Bennett, that racist bastard. That's the same scumbag piece of crap that said that the crime rate would decrease if more black babies were aborted. But that's another thing. But what about the
it's very
whole
simple,
charter
and it would. I would ask your listeners to visualize it like this. These banks that were making subprime loans, all right, for mortgages for the last 15, 20 years, all right, because the American working class, once they there was an oversupply of labor, they couldn't get a wage increase. they were squeezed from low productivity, couldn't get a wage increase, so they turned to credit. That was the only way the last 30 years a lot of people even made it. Eventually, cannibalizing everything they owned. We've lost $50 trillion in value assets, just the value of assets in the world within the last 2 years. And so that's the amount of the GDP of all countries for 1 year. $50 trillion just wiped off the books through these clever Wall Street. What they did with the subprime loans is what they're doing with the charter schools, except instead of subprime loans, they're dealing with what I call, they would call, subprime kids. And so every kid is a dollar. If you can get the federal government to turn over the money that attaches to the kid, so each kid, when they go to school, a certain amount of money is funded for the kid. It could be $6,000 in this state, $8,000 in another state. And that kid carries that money metaphorically in their pocket when they go to the school. And if it's a public school, then the public goes into the public coffers. And then out of the public coffers or general fund, costs are paid. And if they go to a private charter school, or if they go to a charter school that's run by a, quote, nonprofit, unquote, board, which is another hype, and we can talk about the Harlem Children's Zone if you want, because there's a Goldman Sachs that's on the board of many of these nonprofits. Okay, then what they can do is they can open these schools, and the kids come to the door with the money in their pocket. Instead of going to the general fund of a public school, it goes into the private fund of a for-profit or a nonprofit, which is, in the case of the nonprofit, is then just paid out through the back door by contracting private services. So they set up a nonprofit. They get a 501c3. They say that they're really not operating for profit. They get X amount of money, and then they subcontract out their cafeterias, their counselors, and so they privatize through the back door. So charter schools are a Trojan horse for vouchers. See, vouchers wouldn't sell in the 1990s when they tried it. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, is where they tried vouchers. Okay. And I covered this extensively in a book I wrote in 2000 called Vouchers and the Privatization of Education some 11 years ago, is actually how the right wing and all the players involved at the time were cobbling this together. But they couldn't sell vouchers. The experiment, the unions beat it back. The experiment failed, number one, of course, and the union. But the main thing is the organized working class and parents and children beat it back. So they needed another way to get their hands on education because it represents a huge amount of the American economy. And if you can privatize it and turn it into Wall Street derivatives and hedge funds and get people to invest in it, and then you can trade it and sell it and bundle it and sell it to other countries and sell it to other banks, and banks can trade it amongst themselves. And so you've really commodified education and turned it into just a for-profit generating financial scheme. And that's all it is. It's a scheme. Now, there are definitely people out there, and I'm in a community where there's charter schools, and I started a charter school in 1997 on the border of Arizona and Mexico in Nogales. We started this in Arizona, ironically enough, the state of 12 of the hideous legislation, right on the border, because we had young kids that were getting killed in the public education system. And this is, and then I'll close on this, this is what we need to be also speaking about, is the public education system was really never a bastion of critical thinking or a place where people were taught to think about imperialism or racism or sexism or homophobism. And so it's this is where we are. This is the business
right.
deal. It's a business deal, Paul.
Yeah, Danny, Peter Fowler on the line here.
Hi, Peter.
And I'm glad that you opened up your remarks by talking about it in terms of the economy and in the language of capital and labor. In particular, your emphasis on the financialization of the U.S. economy that started a couple decades ago, and almost an inevitable result of that process is this attack on public education. And if we look at, you know, some of those capitalists or those the ruling class, we see some of the names out front in terms of this so-called reform movement in education today. We see like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation putting up huge amounts of money. We see Eli Broad's name. We see the Walton family. So, you know, and obviously that's painted in a positive, you know, positive light, you know, like they're these great philanthropists who want to help reform education. What's really going on there? Help us understand, you know, why would they have any interest in this bigger scheme with education and kind of the broader picture that you just painted? And what's really going on there? What are their motivations, and what is their end game in terms of why they're involved in this project?
Well, Peter, and again, this is my judgment, and in terms of Bill Gates, I believe a part of it is because he actually believes it. He's a dropout himself, and really never liked school, and so, you know, he actually, I think, really believes in a lot of what he's talking about. In the case of Eli Broad, this person, of course, he's started Sun Homes, which are just housing developments, and overbuilt all of them as well during the financial crisis. He's just an out-and-out capitalist. But basically, these are not philanthropists. These are pirates. And
right.
These people go overseas and they exploit labor for 70 cents an hour, okay? And they make billions and billions of dollars. And then they have to wash themselves clean, so they come out in the public in a nice white suit. Now they call themselves philanthropists. These are the same people that don't pay their wages, like Walmart, for example, and won't pay fair wages, or that withhold wages illegally from their workers, like Microsoft, or in the case of Eli Broad, that use immigrant labor and don't pay them correctly. I mean, these are not philanthropists. They're only philanthropists if you accept capitalism. See, if you accept the paradigm of capitalism, where a certain, you know, ruling class is smarter than we are, and, you know, they should organize the way we live, and we just fall in line and hang our heads and, you know, keep our heads down and go to work if we have work, or stay home, take psychotropic drugs and give ourselves lobotomies, watch mindless television, or then they appear as, you know, philanthropists. But if you look at under the seedy side, in the corners of the room, they're exploiters. And so they're in the terms of Bill Gates, to answer your question more explicitly, they have the money to start to prime the pump. They have billions of dollars that they can give to cities to overturn unions, set up call centers, push charter schools, buy the media, elect politicians. And in this way, they destroy public education, and that's what they want to do. They want to destroy public education because they don't want a public system. They want us to live in a privatized, feudal system where we have no public. There's no shared commons. It's individualism. It's the on-your-own ownership society. Go it alone, buddy. It's social Darwinism. And they also know that there's no way that anybody that graduates college today is going to even get a job. So this is containment. It's part of a containment issue. And it also is a financial issue for them. They make money. Like I say, Wall Street is big. Wall Street is behind the whole reform movement. There's going to be an international. There's going to be a upcoming conference in March. Your listeners might want to know about it. It's an international conference on education being hosted in New York by Duncan and his international pals, and there'll be, you know, members of countries flown all the way over to New York to talk about best practices in education and how we can get teachers on board. And this is an international movement. This is not just national. So the privatization of education is complete in Britain. It's complete. You have elementary schools owned by Dubai corporations. It's absolutely complete. They contract their education. Probation departments are contracted out in Britain. Their entire social contract has been shredded. Everything has been privatized. And you have countries that actually own part of Britain's social fabric. You know, they run their probation departments, social service departments. They contract out to countries. And that's what eventually is going to happen here if we don't stop them.
Yeah, and Danny, I'm glad you brought that up. If you could, you know, talk about, because correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe based on my studies and particularly, you know, pointing at the study that was done not too far from where you live at Stanford University, I mean, it's just incredible. And I guess, you know, within a capitalist environment, you know, you're able to, you know, the same way you're able to buy votes, you can use that same money to create this illusion. And to make something that is not true, you know, actually make it as though it is true. And that's the whole notion that charter schools actually are better or outperform public schools. But based on the Stanford study, you know, it showed that only 17% of the time did, you know, charter schools outperform, you know, provide superior educational opportunities for students. And, you know, more than half the time, you know, public schools were performing, you know, on par with charter schools, and then something like 37% of the time, public schools were outperforming charter schools. Am I right on that?
Yeah,
the whole notion that charter schools are better is not really true.
Well, the report you're referring to came out from Stanford in 2009. It's called the Credo Report, C-R-E-D-O. And Stanford University looked at it, and they came to the determination that charter schools students do not do any better than public school students. But from my point of view, it's a false comparison, and I'll tell you why. Because the standards in public schools are not very good. In other words, we don't have public schools that are teaching wonderful critical thinking, places where students are looking forward to going every day. We have public schools that have been underfunded for 30 years, where class size is up to 60, where the curriculum has been dummied down or has been purchased from corporate textbook company like Pearson's out of England, who are now starting their own charter schools. You see, these companies, of these huge media companies now are finding it very profitable to start to be investing in education. And we can talk later about the Washington Post's investment in Kaplan University. But this is not limited to Pearson's in England is investing in charter schools. They don't call them charter schools there. They call them free schools. But they're exactly the same thing. They operate under the economy exactly the same, as I said, with the kid coming with the money to the door. Once again, I kind of got lost. I started a charter school in Arizona with some people because we were concerned of students generally of color falling through the cracks. I can understand why people are not happy with public schools, but the issue is not to pull out of public schools. The issue is to fix them, to change them, to invest in them, to make them places where people want to learn and want to teach, to make them just as beautiful as the most beautiful malls we have in this country. But unfortunately, we don't want to do that. Our rulers don't want to do it. And we have a deracinated public that's very confused. I mean, our culture is exhausted. I mean, it's just exhausted. People are absolutely exhausted. You know, from just 30 years of battering ram, and then you turn on the television controlled by Comcast, you know, and it's just mindless, vagrant chatter. So you've got people that don't understand what's going on, and therefore these studies can sneak by. But the comparison is really a false one, because the public schools aren't really doing that great a job. Now, I know there are many public school teachers, and I'm one of them. I teach at a public college. Okay, my public college is not doing a very good job. So I don't want to compare my college with a private college. This isn't going to do me any good. What we need to do is to talk about what it means to be an educated person in today's society. And once we answer what does it mean to be an educated person in today's society, we can put together a curriculum to meet our needs. And people then can use the curriculum as a guide or however they want to do it locally or whatever. But we haven't even had that debate. Ironically, we did have the debate in the Dewey Lipman times of the 1930s, but we haven't had the debate because it won't be allowed to be had on television. It's all about test scores, raising test scores, metrics, benchmarks, surveillance, panoptic viewing of children, control. It's very much prison-like, you know, 360. And kids are under the microscope all day, testing, doing tests, making tests, meeting tests, learning how to stand in line, how to wear a uniform, how never to answer, ask questions, how to follow. This is obedience training. It's not education. It's obedience training.
Thank you. That's great.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's a hell of a narrative. And so I just want to pick up on that thought in terms of the narrative that's been been created, and what is behind this ideology, you know, in terms of how we convince a public that that this is best for the public. I mean, you know, I just read about a school in Compton where the parents actually petitioned to have their school replaced with a charter school. Because they had bought into, you know, the narrative that charter schools would be the answer. You know, we see the movie like Waiting for Superman coming out, and so, you know, what kind of ideology, you know, are we seeing for the creation of what essentially, you know, if I understand correctly, we're going to end up with, you know, class-based education. You know, what's behind all that?
I believe, Peter, it's fascism, and I want to go to page 44 of edition of 1984, written by George Orwell, I think, which pretty much sums it up, where he says, you know, in his book he creates what's called a Ministry of Truth, and this book was written in 1944. Orwell was very prescient, and part of what the Ministry of Truth had to do, you know, and I'm just going to quote it. Here were produced rubbishy newspapers containing almost nothing except sport, crime, and astrology, sensational 5-cent novelettes, films oozing with sex, and sentimental songs which were composed entirely by mechanical means on a special kind of kaleidoscope known as a versificator. There was even a whole subsection, pornosec, it was called in newspeak, engaged in producing the lowest kind of pornography, which was sent out in sealed packets, and which no party member other than those who worked on it was permitted to look at. We have a society that's being controlled. This is an authoritarian fascist society. People are being fed lies through multinational corporate news, through the rubbishy magazines that he talked about. I mean, you know, all the way down to the porn. I mean, he almost had it right on. Okay, the versificator was the television, you know. So this is what happens in a society that that's rigidly controlled by a small oligarchy, where they're consistently in fear that the population is going to erupt, and so very much like the dictators in Egypt or Libya or Tunisia or anywhere else, it's just now control. You make sure that people don't get able to get their hands on news, and therefore indict WikiLeaks, make sure they don't have anything like that, destroy these organizations, do psy-sops on the population by controlling their mind through the rubbishy newspapers and the, you know, all the stuff that I read that Orwell talked about, and then to completely restructure the social system in such a way that social mobility isn't even expected anymore. See, we may be the only generation left that expects social mobility, that can even remember it. Because once a population, a couple of generations, have gotten used to being slaves in this situation, then they don't expect much of anything else.
Uh-huh.
And history becomes a long-lost narrative or memory that's controlled by the Ministry of Truth as well. And so, you know, it's a dystopic vision. But the issue today is really to witness history as an activist and not as a spectator, and that's what I'd like to just say. I don't know how much time we have left. We are in a 1968 moment. Remember Martin Luther King. in March of 1968. He appeared. There were 1,200 striking black people in Memphis. There were garbage workers and sewage workers. Remember? March 18, 1968. And his quote, quote, "All labor has dignity," unquote. He called for a general strike that day in Tennessee. Okay? And what was the general strike over? Was it over higher wages? A little bit, but not much. It was over the right to have collective bargaining.
Mm.
So we are right back 43 years later in a 1968, March 18th, Martin Luther King, you know. And we can only hope a general strike will occur in this country.
Right. And Peter, Danny, that's great segue to what I was going to ask you is that you just, you know, painted this backdrop, this very vivid backdrop, you know, with the, you know, with the reading of 1984 and then, you know, and then illustrating, you know, what the likes of Dr. King were seeking back in 1968 and looking at the collective bargaining. My question is Danny, is that as we see what's going on in Wisconsin and what we see, you know, the attack on labor unions and, you know, the corporate media, whether it's Fox News, the MSNBC that, you know, portrays itself as a liberal, we see folks even attacking, you know, labor unions there. You know, I saw, you know, Governor Christie was actually on MSNBC. You know, they were touting him around as if he was like some kind of hero. You know, it was either this morning or yesterday. I think it was yesterday morning. And so, Danny, my question is you, where do you see this movement going? Because, and if you could talk about Governor Christie, because he's even, I mean, Cory Booker, who's like a miniature Barack Obama, you know, miniature from the standpoint that, you know, he's governing a smaller sphere of space. But he's been painted as some, you know, liberal, you know, the next coming of Barack Obama or what have you, and you know he and Governor Christie have made themselves, you know, some would say strange bedfellows, but you know I think they're quite comfortable, you know, doing business with one another, and Governor Christie, you know, making these extreme cuts and saying that he's right on board with what, you know, Governor Walker has been doing and. In Wisconsin, and now we see what's going on in Providence, Rhode Island. And, you know, the backdrop, we know what happened in Central Falls, you know, a year ago, and Providence, Rhode Island. Where do you see this going, Danny? Because you just mentioned that, you know, are we gonna see mass strikes, you know, across this country, and that's what's needed. What is on the precipice? What's in the future in terms of Wisconsin, and where's the next battle going to be fought, and what I hope to see a metastasization, you know, that knocks out this evil system that is taking so many lives.
Well, I'm not as wise as George Orwell was, evidently, but I just a couple of answers for you. First of all, in terms of Governor Christie, I've written a lot on a Daily Censored more last year when I got whiff of Christie and what was going on in New Jersey. The insidious Cory Booker, I don't have time to go deeply into Cory Booker tonight, but Booker is a shill for the corporations. He has been able to lure, along with Joel Klein, out of they used to be the superintendent of schools in New York. They work very closely together to lure charter schools into the state of New Jersey, as well as to help set up the New Jersey Charter School Fund, which was then immediately funded by Bill Gates. They just dropped money into it. He's much like Robert Bob, the financial manager in Detroit, who's a shill for Eli Broad. These are full black politicians. And they're right up there with Sharpton. They're Sharpies. They know what they're doing. They want a piece of the corporate action. They have no interest in change. They're looking for power and money. And so, but in terms of what's going to happen, we can only hope. And again, it's very difficult to say from my point of view because we're such a large country and we're not the United States, we're a divided state. We can only hope that there's going to be a general strike. Because if Wisconsin people lose, in other words, I think a number of outcomes are possible. One, the people in Wisconsin lose. They go back to their homes, they hang their heads, they pay more in their pensions, more in their health care, and they accept no collective bargaining, and they lose. If that happens, we have 12 other states minimum triggered to do the exact same thing. You've already seen Indiana, you're seeing Ohio, and Christie is, of course, waiting. Now, Christie has bigger aspirations. See, everybody wants to use this not just to break unions, but also to get personal power, to become the next Caesar of the falling Rome. So Christie wants to be president, Walker wants to be president, so Walker triggered it first, they had Christie triggered it. Walker gets away with it, he's a big man. The Koch brothers will love him, and all the billionaires will love him because he's a hand tool. So these politicians are hand tools, and the real wizard behind the curtain are the corporate Wall Street. So what's going to happen? We can only hope that the dissent continues to spread. If people go to Daily Censored, they'll see where are their demonstrations this Saturday in 50 capitals in the United States. And we just need to get out, and we need to change policy. We need to raise taxes on corporations in every state. We need to raise taxes on wealthy individuals in every state, right? And we can fund everything that we need socially, but we have to take the government back. They own the government. They own all the government. And that's what Mussolini had. So we can either sink into a Mussolini situation, much like in France under Franco, when their civil war in 1936 that Orwell also wrote about, where Franco won, or we can win. And that is organized in our unions, in our communities. There's a lot going on in every state, as I say, this Saturday. And we need to political organize. We need a political organization. And then we can do what Tunisia did, and we can do what Egypt did, and we can do what's going on in Libya right now. But if we don't, then we'll be one of the other. We'll become more oppressive while the world becomes freer.
Danny, I just want to take a moment to make sure our listeners are clear about Daily Censored, because you've mentioned that site a couple times, so I want to make sure our listeners have the opportunity to go to Daily Censored, check out your pieces, and also some of the stuff you've mentioned. Daily Censored is a great website for progressive information and news and analysis. That's dailycensored.com. That's one word, Daily Censored, D-A-I-L-Y. CENSORED.com. So check it out, and you can find Danny's writings on there, Solomon's, as well as a couple of my own pieces on there. Find out what's going on and get involved. Then Danny, let me just follow up with this. Then you mentioned Joe Klein and a couple other people, and there's Michelle Rhee, who's also part of the Hatchet Club, and then there's these buzzwords, these catchphrases, a lot of things that we hear. You've mentioned a couple of them already tonight, like vouchers and things like that. So what I want to ask you is, for those of us who engage people in conversation on from day to day and so forth, and this conversation comes up, what would be some of the ammunition that you would provide for those of us who are listening, to respond to folks who aren't familiar with what's really behind vouchers? What is the real what are vouchers doing to the education system? What's the bottom line with this race to the top initiative? What's the bottom line with all this standardized testing? What is teacher accountability? What does that really mean? Merit pay, those kind of things. What's really going on behind these words that are being bandied about under the rubric of reform? What do they really mean? And how can we say, well, no, here's what this means, and deconstruct that narrative to get a better understanding of what's going on?
Well, I think we must understand that ignorance is not strength, and freedom is not slavery. And I think that in the American mind right now, much like Orwell had indicated, people really believe freedom is slavery, and they believe that ignorance is strength. We are living in a post-literate society where very few people read newspapers that are even disappearing right now. There are 105 disappeared within the last 18 months. So there are very few dailies or anything anymore. People must go to alternative news. They've got to go to Russia Today as a news station on, if you get these Comcast or Dish Networks or whatever, you'll find Russia Today. Go to Free Speech Television. Go to Al Jazeera if you're in one of the two states that's able to get it in the United States. But you must go to other news media outlets. And I would encourage people to use as much electronic as possible, because nobody has the time to read all this stuff. It's exhausting. I mean, I've been doing it for 40 years. So, you know, I've made a vocation out of it. But the average person who has to work for a living, or who's got to make sure that they're, you know, waiting for the unemployment office to call for the interview to make sure they can continue to their unemployment or whatever, we don't have this. It's time to do this. So definitely seek other alternative points of view. Have a great deal of skepticism with what anybody in power says. Anybody. Madison, one of the, quote, founding fathers of this country, said it well. Don't trust anybody with power. Nobody with power. Okay. That just doesn't work. It's the powerless narrative that you want to hear. Listen to the narrative of the disenfranchised, not just the narrative of the powerful. So that would be one way that I would encourage people to do it. But the better way to do it is get involved in an organization. If you're young and you live in Detroit, you might want to look at Voces de la Frontera, which is an immigrant organization that will be marching on Saturday, bringing out students and parents. If you don't fall into that category or are not interested in that issue, find another organization. There are many organizations. If you're a woman and there's a woman's organization, if you're a Pan-Africanist, there's many organizations. Find an organization, because with numbers you'll educate yourself. Individually, we can't do it from our homes. There's no way. Even I can't keep up on it. And I'm a 24/7 news person, constantly something on. I would have a wall full of televisions from around the world if I could, and I still couldn't keep up on it. We
right.
need each other.
Oh.
We need to be doing what you're doing, dialoguing amongst each other, and replacing schooling with education. Remember what Mark Twain
right.
once said, I'll never let schooling get in the way of my education. We don't educate human beings in this country. We train them. Whether
right.
it's public or private, we train them. And I don't want to be trained. I want to be educated. And so to
right.
be educated, you have to have a passion for living and a passion for thinking. And you have to be skeptical and constructively doubt and critically reflect on your own thoughts. Seek out other points of view, especially those that don't agree with you. Try to reconcile what you believe with what other people believe. And then ask yourself, how did I come to believe what I believe? And what would I say to people who didn't agree with me? This is the kind of critical thinking we need to be teaching in schools. It's the moment that we can seize right now. This is a teachable moment. And all those people in Wisconsin and Ohio and Indiana sitting together right now have the ability to dialogue and teach each other and let each other know what's going on and network and organize, and then we can win. And we can do the Paris Commune again, only this time we can do it well. And there doesn't have to be
right.
a split between groups. And then we can take over the means of production. So they're not privately
right.
held by a few select few.
Definitely. Danny, I would be totally remiss if I didn't, touch on this, before you got off air. And one of the things is that I wanted to touch on is, we look at, most folks, that they've been living under a rock, know, what happened, what led up to 2008 with the so-called bubble bursting, the subprime housing debacle that was made here right in the U.S. of A. and on Wall Street and other large financial sectors, within this country, causing a global economic crisis, food prices soaring, people like literally dying because of the rapacious actions of coming out of Wall Street, dare I say, Capitol Hill. Danny, right now we're seeing another subprime crisis occurring. It's been going on for a while, and it's been under the radar. But now, as you mentioned, RT, folks, you can go to Google and type in Russia TV, or you can go to Google and type in Al Jazeera English, and you can watch You can watch a lot of the newscasts and programs that these channels feature from your laptop or your desktop computer. But you know, Danny, you were on Russia TV. I saw that interview that you when you appeared on there, you know, talking about the for-profit college industry, you know, such as Kaplan, which is part of the Wall Street Company, and you know, Wall Street Company, Wall Street. I'm sorry, Washington Post, the Washington Post Company, you know, owns Kaplan, and you know, Washington Post Company actually makes more money from, you know, Kaplan than it does on actually selling newspapers. But Danny, if you could shed some light on this crisis right now, like, what are we talking about in the magnitude of what is owed by folks? And we know that, you know, it's a lot of poor folks that have aspirations that, you know, because, you know, because as you mentioned, you know, not everyone in this country is supposed to go to college, and that's by design. Not everyone in this country is supposed to go to Stanford or University of Maryland or, you know, Harvard or, you know, Santa Cruz, and that's by design. And so you have folks that have aspirations of making it, and they've been sold these lofty, you know, promises that, you know, if they go to one of these places, you know, ITT Tech or Phoenix, you know, or Kaplan, that they're gonna make it. They're gonna make it. But what happens, Danny? It seems like they're going to debt. Like, what's the magnitude of the debt that is owed, and how nefarious a tangled web are we actually looking at in terms of this for-profit, you know, education industry that's booming out there right now? Hello.
Oh,
Peter, are you with me? I think we
He's
lost.
I'm here,
Solomon.
Did we lose Danny?
Yeah, I think we lost some folks that have a technical difficulty. I don't know if it's on his line, but hopefully Danny will call back. Hopefully he heard my question. I need to pat myself on the back. I phrased that quite well. But
yeah, I was actually. That's why. Yeah, I was. You know, I want to hear this answer. This is good stuff.
Yeah. So hopefully he'll call right back, because he's done a lot of work, and maybe I'll pose the question to you, Peter, because, you know, you and I have read a lot on this, but, like, and Peter, you know, you sent me a great piece that, you know, way back in the fall that you had read on the socialist site. And, you know, and this is great expose, Peter, that showed, I mean, you know, we're looking at, it's something, I believe it was something like, if I'm not wrong, I believe it was something like $800 billion, you know, people are in arrears or owing these, you know, these for-profit colleges. Right now, I mean, actually, that's not it. It was that, and also combination to the fact that it was also in combination with the money that students that have graduated from actually traditional colleges they owe in terms of their debt that has been, you know, sold off to the Student Loan Corporation, which is based out of I believe Montana, but actually. Hey, Danny's back on. Danny,
yes,
did you,
I am
you
back.
Hear that?
I apologize.
Did you hear
to
that
you?
Question I asked? That's all
no,
right.
I didn't. I heard the question you had asked about. Yes, about. And I know we don't have much time. I apologize to
listeners.
That's
all right.
We can
take it to the bell.
Yeah, just to the end of the bell here, we're facing a very huge crisis, so listeners should know. There's over $829 billion in student loan debt that's outstanding right now.
Okay.
The great majority of it is owed as a result of private for-profit colleges enrolling homeless, drug addicts, people at shopping centers, laundromats. They cruise like milk trucks down in housing districts, and they enroll students. They then cash the students in for Title IV money or Pell Grant money. It's $1 trillion. We have $1 trillion in debt in credit cards. So private consumer debt right now, just between the credit cards and the colleges, is $2 trillion. Now, this doesn't even talk about the public debt. This is private debt. There's no way that anybody's going to dig their way out of this. And we're facing now the problem of peak oil. Peak oil is definitely hitting. We have prices over $100 a barrel. Peak oil always accompanies these crises, is always there. So we're looking at a very dire situation. And the for-profit colleges, the government says they want to regulate them, but the colleges themselves are spending, at this point, over $3.5 million on lobbying efforts. They've hired Lanny Davis, a former Clinton a spokesperson, to shill for them, to lobby Congress, basically bring suitcases of money and bribe them, et cetera. The good news is that the students are beginning to organize there as well. I got an email from a woman named Shannon today, who's a former Kaplan student. She put together a group of Kaplan students, and she started fighting and put together a website. And, of course, Kaplan immediately called her and told her she didn't know anything and offered her a free education. But she said, no, she didn't want that. Make a long story short, the Washington Post organization, it trades on the New York Stock Exchange at $415 a share as of today. They own Kaplan Universities and three other subsidiaries of Kaplan. Kaplan is their blood bank. They wouldn't exist as a newspaper if it wasn't revenues for Kaplan. The good news is the revenues are going down. 47% a cut in enrollment this quarter as a result of a lot of work that journalists and people like Shannon are doing to expose the fraudulent activities. So they're down 47% in enrollment. They went down from 81.7 million in revenues of last year down to 79 million this year. Now, your listeners might say, well, that's still a lot of money. Sure it is. But their advertising is declining. The Washington Post advertising has declined by 12%. I am predicting that the Washington Post will fold, and we can only hope it will, because it's involved in what we can call Edugate right now as opposed to Watergate. They are covering up their own crimes, their own slaughterhouse. The blood's all over their hands, and they won't print a word of it. You've got to go to Russian television or, again, go to Free Speech TV, another very, very good television you can get in DirecTV or Dish Network, or Free Speech News. These are all connected, or Pacifica, or WBAI, and just type keywords in, and you'll be able to find out what's going on. So Kaplan is hurting. Their stocks have been shorted. It's just a vehicle, again, just to make money. So we can only hope that it can go out of business. That's the one thing we're trying to do, is to drive it out of business, not regulate it, drive it out of business. There should be no commons, public commons, that is privatized. We should have a public common area, and it should not be privatized. And now we're fighting just for a public common area. So these poor students are graduating with debt, sometimes $76,000, with a degree in culinary arts that they saw television ads sandwiched in between college ads telling them they can be mechanics, cooks, and they're finding not only are there no jobs, but they can't write the debt off. It's not, you can't dismiss it in bankruptcy. So it follows you everywhere. You can't get a credit history. You can't rent an apartment. You can't get a phone. You can't, and this is the subprime. This is all part of the neo-feudalism that I was talking about earlier.
Right. Well, I want to thank you, Danny.
I wanted to just make a comment, but I know we're short on time.
No, please do, Peter.
Yeah.
Okay. You've mentioned twice now, Danny, the descent back into or into a neo-feudalism. And, you know, we can talk about those kind of terms. But, you know, for a culture that largely, you know, has not been educated but has been trained, like you said, and, you know, the concept of history has been, you know, basically just non-existent. It's hard for some people to understand what that means, you know, what you're talking about when you say a neo-feudalism. What does that really mean? If you could just talk about when you talk about, say, neo-feudalism, what kind of realities are we looking at in the 21st century?
We could be looking at a digital dark ages if we don't do something about what we're going through now, if we don't approach history as activists and not spectators. And that means that if you look at the 8th century or the 10th century after the fall of Rome, it was the medieval or middle ages, and the way the system was oriented was feudalism. And it was basically a tripartite system. There were those that ruled, and they were the nobility, and they owned all the land, and that there were those who worked for them, who were the serfs, and they got a they were not workers because they didn't receive a wage. They slept in the barn on the corporate property, on the property, which would now be corporate property, and they would be given a pittance of what they produced in wealth. And then there were those who ruled ideas, and that was the church. And we may be headed back to a digital dark ages now, where we have more people believing in superstition than reasoning. We may abdicate reasoning completely, have other people abdicate our control and freedom because it's easier to do, have other people control how we live. But I think what's going to be the stopper on this really is climate change and peak oil and resource management. And that's a whole other discussion for another night. But that's what I mean by the terminology. It's a different way of governing people. It's a pyramid structure where the very, very top is a 1% and the very, very bottom is just a milling mass of uneducated people who are just controlled or imprisoned or... And then there's a church telling them that this is all that God wanted them to do and that one day there would be a better place for them when they die. And this is all ordained. And I'm afraid
so
that...
So it's a very bleak reality. So it's a very bleak picture.
It doesn't have to be. I mean, Wisconsin and all these states are showing us what we can do if we organize.
Right, right.
And that's really the way I'd like to end, is on not hope. Old historian in Greece once said, hope is good, but preparation is better. And I think he was right. And be prepared. Let's just hope that we can organize our efforts.
Yes, excellent.
All right.
Great.
Thanks so much, Danny. And perhaps next time, because this will not be the last time you're on the show, yeah, we can... delve into peak oil, because I know you've done a lot of research around that, and I know you went to a lecture on that in San Fran the other day. So, I think that's something that needs to have light shed on, you know, so people can prepare for this and try to, you know, dare I say, you know, start to have some kind of, create some kind of community style, you know, cooperative neighborhoods, you know, to prepare
Absolutely.
For this.
Absolutely.
You know.
So, well, I want to thank you for having your show, and I hope that any listeners out there that are interested in what you're doing, you know, spread the word and get more listeners to your show and cross-link to all those good media outlets that we all talked about, from Al Jazeera to Free Speech TV, from Russian TV to WBAI, and begin to, you know, scent a different world other than the corporate media.
Yeah, thanks. Definitely. Thanks so much, Danny.
You be well, both of you.
All right, bye-bye. You too. Take care.
Bye-bye.
And that was Danny Weil, and as Peter said before, I mean, there's a website you absolutely just have to check out. Danny has written on that website so frequently, and has written, and if any of the stuff that he was speaking about interests you, which it should, you know, check his writing out. It's a factual content with a perspective that just quite frankly you're not going to get anywhere on the corporate media, whether it's print, radio, or television, and that's Daily Censored. So go to Daily Censored at DailyCensored.com, Daily Censored, and you can read his stuff. And if you want to, you know, contact him, you can contact him via that website. You can, post, you know, comment, and he will get back to you. He will most certainly get back to you. I can assure you that. So, Peter, here we are now. I mean, you know, he put stuff into bright context. I mean, looking at $829 billion of student loan debt that's looming out there, and that includes me. I mean, you know, I owe a rack of money from undergrad and grad school, as I'm sure you do as well, Peter, you know, because, you know, and so we're looking at something that we were talking about before, Peter, you know, last week or earlier this week with, you know, the cutting of the Pell Grants. And even before that, Pell Grants didn't, you know, cover your entire tuition for most students. It covered a portion of that, the high cost of going to college in this country. And so even if you're considered, you know, coming from a poor household, most likely, this is not for everybody, but most likely you're not going to get everything covered by the Pell Grant, and certainly not now when we see that the Obama administration has cut the Pell Grants but yet raised the expenditure to defense. Peter, it, it, it leaves us, yeah, it's a very bleak situation out there. I mean, that's $829 billion. That's a lot of money that's owed out there from a multitude of former, you know, college students, whether it's from proprietary or profit, you know, for-profit schools. And I think that actually, you know, I think actually that's almost like a misnomer, because whether it's University of Arizona or Stanford, I think they're also, their businesses run as well. They're run like businesses, and they're for-profit as well. But, Peter, where do we look? I mean, I think Danny brought up a good point, is that we need to start having these conversations on a community level, you know, and it starts with, you know, your friends, your family, and we need to start looking at having these conversations on a community level, whether it's organizing town hall meetings, meetings in the basement of churches or community centers, and really starting to, like, really starting to seriously organize, Peter, from a cooperative standpoint, and preparing, as Danny said, preparing for what's coming down, you know, down the pike, failure to prepare is what preparing to fail. And so, you know, Peter, I think that us people are listening, you know, concerned folks, we need to start taking this dialogue literally,
right,
to the streets,
yeah,
you know, and start to build, you know, this stuff. And folks need to get their heads out of their asses and start to look at things like, you know, cooperative communities, you know, even doing things on a local level and trying things out, Peter, you know, where you know, I know some college students, matter of fact, Peter, not too far from where I live, I know some college students very well, where they just created community housing, where they actually pulled their money together, and they pool their money together, and they're actually, you know, paying on the mortgage for a house, but everything is cooperative. Everything is cooperative, and it's like a, you know, it's like a small, like, rinky-dink house, but they figured they were getting nickel and dimed and hosed by, you know, on camp, by living on campus in the dormitories, and also with the meal plan, the exorbitant meal plan, and you know, in terms of the price, and they all chip in something like $20 a week, and they have more than enough food to eat from a week to week basis. They go do their grocery shopping together, but that's just a small example, and it's just refreshing to see young students, you know, moving away from this capitalist model and looking more so at a you know, if you want to use the word socialist, fine. If you want to use the word, you know, communist, fine. You know, but to me, it's more like a communal type thing, a shared thing, a cooperative thing. You know, I don't know what your thoughts are on Peter.
Well, a couple of things. You know, a lot of thoughts going through my mind now after, you know, the mad knowledge that Danny just dropped on us. I mean, a couple of things, you know, with the amount of debt that he was talking about, and that most of it has its cause in most of us. One of the things we need to realize, you know, that this occurrence, relatively recent occurrence of these, you know, these for-profit educational organizations, you know, that's part of what Danny was talking about at the top of the show or top of the interview, in terms of the financialization of the U.S. economy. You know, we've got to understand, you know, this is part of the, you know, the critique of the current system. We've got to understand that the current system is highly financialized, you know, and the dominant industries in this country are what we call, you know, the economists call FIRE, F-I-R-E, which, you know, just an acronym for finance, insurance, and real estate. You know, so this whole debt system, you know, Danny put out some, you know, he cited some just tremendous figures in terms of the amount of debt that Americans have, just private debt, whether it's school debt, credit debt, what have you. And we have to understand that has been systematically foisted upon us in a very purposeful and methodical way, because it is a means for the ruling class to make more money. Okay, so debt has been commodified as a thing to generate more income. You know, so we need to understand that. You know, and it's fantastic to hear that example of the the students that you just referenced who got together and said, you know what, there's a system here that's working against us, okay? And so we need to have that kind of that kind of critical analysis, the critical thinking that Danny alluded to. And I also say this, where there's no revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement, all right? What I mean is we need to have this dialogue, like Danny said. Get together, join organizations, and you just reiterate it, so that we can have a systematic, first of all, critique and analysis of the current situation, and then a systematic understanding of how to replace it. Because, you know, I mean, think about what would happen if the movement in Wisconsin and in Ohio and you know, let's say it just caught fire and moved to Minnesota and other states, what would happen? What would we have next? We don't have an oppositional philosophy in this country, largely because the ruling class has squelched any conversation and any dialogue about anything that's anti-capitalist, especially since post-World War II, you know, with McCarthyism and the Red Scare and with COINTELPRO and the FBI and hunting down the Black Panthers and the Black Liberation Movements, you know, anything that's anti-capitalist or presents an alternative theory has been just squelched and obliterated by the ruling class, and it's very purposeful. All right, so we need to generate a competing theory. All right, there is something else out there. Capitalism is not the only thing. Danny talked about feudalism. Feudalism was a system that predated capitalism, all right? And that's, you know, folks need to know that. Folks need to know the evolution of these economic systems and that capitalism is not the only thing. You know, he talked about, you know, this superstition and mythology, how, like, in the Dark Ages, the Middle Ages, you know, it was religion. It was largely the Christian church in the West and Islam in other parts of Europe and Arabia and North Africa, but you know, organized religion taught this superstition and these mythologies that kept people ignorant. And religion is not the only ideology today. Religion is certainly one of them, you know. But this capitalist propaganda is largely, you know, it is propaganda because it foists on us this idea that capitalism is it. You know, that's the highest form of civilization, and that's the only alternative, and there is no other way to live when that is absolutely, absolutely false. And so we need to understand that. We need to get our minds organized around alternative economic systems, alternative social systems, because Danny's right. You know, the way we're moving, and that's why I asked him to talk about that in terms of, you know, this neo-feudalism, it's a very, very bleak potential reality, and people need to understand that. You and I need to understand that. Folks that are listening need to understand that the ruling class, if it has its way, will continue to marginalize and disenfranchise the majority of us because we, as workers, in other words, those of us who don't own the wealth, we are expendable. We're expendable populations. If you think I'm exaggerating it, look to post-Katrina New Orleans. Look at what the ruling class did to New Orleans and is still doing to New Orleans. Look at what they're doing to Detroit. Glenn Ford talked about it at the top of the show. Look what happened. Look what's been happening in Haiti for a century. We're talking about expendable populations, all right? People who are unnecessary to the ruling class in order for them to create more wealth for themselves. Look at the mass incarceration system in this country, expendable people, all right? But there's a big but. It's not necessarily that way. It doesn't have to be that way, right? It doesn't have to be that way. We have the power. We have the power to change the system and to overturn that system, you know. And you know, Karl Marx talked about that and created a tremendous theoretical framework about how those of us who don't have own all the wealth, in other words, those of us that aren't the millionaires and the billionaires, how we have the power. We actually have the power. We control the power to make a different tomorrow, to make that neo-feudalism, you know, just a conversation and not a reality, you know. And so we need to get our minds around, you know, the things that Marx talked about. We need to get our minds around what socialism really is. What call it socialism, like you said, Solomon, it goes by many names, you know. And it existed long before Karl Marx. It existed long before the Paris Commune. So it's not, you know, it's not just a recent phenomenon. But we need, first of all, to start this critique of the current system, and to understand how we have the power, you know. And I'll end my remark on this, just reflecting back on something else Danny said, that 1968 moment. If we look to Memphis, Tennessee, in the spring of 1968, and the way the collective efforts of those garbage men, we're talking about, black garbage collectors in the South, were able to change the system because they organized and they had a plan. They had an alternative framework. They said, no, we refuse think about it. Think about the pictures, you know, the slogans, you know, I am a man, I am somebody. You know, we refuse to be expendable population, expendable people. We refuse this reality that you're trying to foist on us. But we're going to organize, we're going to get together, we're going to see an alternative, and we're going to make that happen collectively. I mean, we can make that happen. And maybe if we look, you know, we can also look to what's happening in Egypt. We can look at what's happening in Libya and Tunisia. Again, the Paris Commune. There's all kinds of bright lights that we can look to say, yeah, there is an alternative, and we can make that happen.
Right. And Peter, you bring this up, and I'll say this right now, as you were talking, it's amazing what kind of spontaneous things can happen when we actually think. A lot of us don't have been programmed not to think. I mean, let alone think critically. But as you were talking, I was just thinking, and I was saying, and I was just kind of thinking about, you know, the different movements of revolution that people have brought about in far more dire situations than what many of us can imagine, like right now in places like, you know, Egypt, Tunisia. We see what's going on now in Libya, so Yemen, you know, Bahrain, and I just think that maybe it could start now. I mean, not start now. I think that it's been in the wind, and the wheels have been moving. I mean, and you see that what folks are doing in Wisconsin, but why not now? Why not folks that are listening right now? You know, start to generate some ideas in terms of organizing within their communities, organizing with Peter and I. You can email us at yourworldnews2010. That's yourworldnews, @gmail.com. That's yourworldnews2010@gmail.com. You know, email us. I mean, if there's some way that we can help, start to put together some kind of, you know, organization, or joining with an organization that's already in existence that you may have already started. If it's about the people, if it's about generating something that's going to provide some alleviation to people's, the duress that people are feeling right now, in terms of not being able to pay their rent, you know, not being able to afford food for their family, and not, you know, because of this onslaught of capitalism, this attack on the workers of this nation, and as we said before at the onset of the show, the chasm between the super rich, the 1%, the 2%, and everybody else has gotten larger. It's gotten larger in the last 30 years. I mean, meanwhile, workers are more productive, but they're being paid less, based around inflation, in 2011 standards than they were, in the 60s and the 70s. So if there's something, and Peter, I put this out to all of us, including, Peter, myself, you know, if we can start to try to think about what we might be able to do in terms of really creating some kind of broad-based social movement to put pressure on those in Capitol Hill, those that are that are corporations that continue to take for granted, you know, the consumers and those that work within their corporations. And it could even be just us, you know, forming more cooperative communities, you know, from D.C. to Phoenix, Arizona, to Mesa, Arizona, to the South Central L.A., to, you know, to Detroit, Michigan. You know, why not now? Why not now? Why not now? Why not here? Why not? I mean, the folks in Wisconsin have something going, you know, why not build upon that? Why not build upon what was built up, you know, that was going on before that? You know, because if we don't, Peter, as you alluded to it, if we don't, this tsunami, this economic tsunami is going to continue to crush. And as Peter, the last show, you beautifully, you know, phrased something as economic violence. This economic violence is going to continue to wreak havoc. We know that crime rates are escalated, you know, because of poverty. We know that. We know that these things lead to a lack of educational opportunities, not just on the college level, but even on the elementary school, middle school level, the high school level, you know, because there's these, you know, this huge chasm between, you know, those that attend schools in poor communities and those that attend schools and communities where you know expensive property is and expensive houses are owned and the taxes funnel into that. If we don't do something about it, it's going to continue to get worse, and the crime rates will continue to stay steady or go up, and even if they don't, you know, the prison industrial complex, which is based on this, these things have to stop. These things have to stop, and they're you know and you know because. If it just goes on right now, unabated, the prison industry is going to continue to grow. You know, why not put this MFR out of business? Why not put all of them, the CCAs, the WAC, the GEO groups, put them all out of business? Put them all out of business because of mass, you know, protests and strikes. Why not? Why not, Peter? I mean, honestly, and I say this as somebody who's saying I'm putting myself out there. I know Peter's willing to put himself out there. I'm putting myself out there to follow, to lead where I'm needed. If we want people want to use Your World News as an organ to get the word out and to start to have shows, contact Peter and I on the Gmail site that we just gave you. Contact us or send us a message on the site that you listen to right now. Contact us and we'll set it up. We'll have the show. Boom, have you on. You know, to voice your ideas, and we'll have a show around you wherever you are. You just have to have a phone. You call in, and we get it going. We're willing to follow and to lead where we're needed. But I'm putting it out there to myself and Peter and everybody else that you know, let's start to think about alternatives. You know, this is the thing that. These are the kind of things that bring about change, and this is the only kind of thing that brings about change. The education is there now. Those of us that are listening to this show, you know, we have, you know, we've educated ourselves, you know, not through somebody else, but through our own critical thinking and read between the lines. Now, what do we do with that education? What do we do now that we know some of the numbers? What do we do now that we know how the onslaught is being, you know, imposed upon us, imposed upon teachers and unions and so forth, and the workers. Now, what do we do? Do we just continue to hold forth without going anywhere and just hold forth on that soapbox, or do we say, okay, we've been on the soapbox, we've started to spread the word. Now let's get down there with the people that have been listening, the people that are outraged, and let's start to build something better. What do you think, Peter? Are you willing to put yourself out there?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, that's why I do this, is why you do this. It's why both of us are involved in the work, kind of work that we've been involved with. And you know, you're right. I love the way you phrased it. You know, well, why not now? Why not us? Why not now? I mean, think about it. We would turn the clock back, you know, 1 year, 2 year, 10 years. I mean, think about the kind of despair that existed in some of the places that are feeling the birth of revolution, you know, right now, like in North Africa, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, you know, some of those places where, you know, the iron fist of some of these dictators, U.S. funded and propped up dictators in most cases, but nevertheless, you know, these iron fisted regimes, totalitarian regimes, were you know, a lot worse shape than many of us are, like you said. And, you know, many of them could have thought that what's happening right now could ever come to pass. And so I say that to say that, you know, I know there's a lot of people that are despairing right now. And so it's easy to not think that we can do something, but we can't. You know, you're right. You're absolutely right. I'm down for it 100%. You know, why not now? Why not us? And we do have the power. You know, I believe in the critical theory of Karl Marx that, you know, that we do have the power to make the change and to create a new and a different world for ourselves. You know, we can see the brilliance of Marx in terms of our topic for tonight, in terms of the way he analyzed how capital needs to expand infinitely. It needs to find new markets. It needs to find new prospects and new raw materials and so forth. And that's exactly what capital is doing now. It is moving into the realm. Even it's not a physical place. It's not like, you know, capital has moved, you know, to China. It's already moved to India. It's already invading Iraq and Afghanistan physically for their resources. But now it's invading different fields and different disciplines and different areas of the economy and the social strata, in this case, education. It's moving into new areas and new industries to create profit for itself. And we can see history demonstrates that everywhere capitalism goes, it leaves death and destruction in its wake. And that's exactly what's happening with public education in this country as capitalism gets a hold of it. So, right. You know, I say that to say, you know, that kind of analysis is the kind of thing that can help us understand where we're at and help us develop a roadmap to where we can go, what kind of world we really want. You know, are we gonna live in the world that's being created by the pirates, like Danny said, or are we going to create something for ourselves, a real livable world filled with peace and harmony and not with racism and hatred and violence?
Right. Yeah, and as soon as we make create a better, more democratic, egalitarian society within the United States of America, you know, that has been founded on theft and plunder of indigenous people and you know, the bringing in of ever since the, you know, the first Africans were brought to the shores of Jamestown 1619, you know, where we're dragged, you know, from actually, they actually came from Barbados. They were brought from Barbados. And you know, we've seen what it was founded on. It's time to change the wind and to make this a much more egalitarian, humanitarian society to live in, that puts, you know, the social needs of all the people first before corporations, before the elites, you know, the so-called well-to-do. But, you know, Peter, what I'm saying is as soon as things change here, then you can surely see where logically things would change for the rest of the world. That means that things would change where corporate plunder could no longer occur in places like Congo and throughout West Africa and you know, throughout Nigeria, you know, with the Shell and Chevron and the other corporations that are there and also in Ecuador and causing all this kind of damage, you know, because the people would put a stop to that. You create a society
that won't allow that, consumers that won't allow corporations to do that. And so we started to create a movement here. The rest of the world literally is depending on it, Peter. That's when you start to see the ending of foreign policy that is based on just the rapacious bombing, you know what I'm saying, carpet bombing, you know, in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, the illegal wars that are based on oil, based on military industrial complex and these private, you know, corporations like Bechtel. You know, so it starts here, and we can literally, you know, create a better world if we can change the fabric of the society that we're living in. And it starts with Peter, myself, and all of us. You know, we're all in this together. Those that, you know, those of us that are actually liberation-minded people, we're in it together, all right? There's some regressives out there that they can stay on their damn boat and sail off the face of the earth, but we're in this together. And so I can't think of a better song than this song to end on. And please tune in and send this all to all your contacts. Send this link so they can hear this important show that we just did and hear all of our subsequent shows that hopefully will feature you and us talking about the building and the sustainment of that movement. So here is a song, and it speaks for itself.
Yet our best trained, best educated, best equipped, best prepared troops refuse to fight. Matter of fact, it's safe to say that they would rather switch than fight.
Okay, talk to me about the future of Public Enemy.
Future of Public Enemy got a